This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat Satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The U.S. Congress approves a major aid package for Ukraine as Washington once again backs a bid by Finland and Sweden to join NATO. China calls for the expansion of a group of emerging economies known as BRICS and the first shakeup of the bloc in over a decade. And a group of lawmakers in the European Union call on the bloc to hold Israel accountable for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. The United States keeps pumping military aid into Ukraine, with Congress now approving a $40 billion aid package for that country. The Senate approved the package on Thursday. Only 11 senators opposed the aid. It includes $6 billion for boosting Ukraine's armored vehicle inventory and air defense system. Shortly after the vote, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken released another $100 million funding for Ukraine. That was approved previously and provides Kiev with 18 new howitzers and some counter-artillery radar. The U.S. continues to send arms to Ukraine despite strong opposition from Russia. Moscow accuses Washington of seeking to wage a proxy war against it and has warned of unpredictable consequences. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, is now with us from San Francisco. Scott, thanks for being with us. Let's just discuss Finland and Sweden's bid to join NATO. And correct me if I'm wrong, but NATO was created in the first place to prevent another world war. And now it seems that U.S.-led NATO is creating another world war by all these provocative moves that it makes day in, day out, despite all the, you know, warnings that are issued by Russia. Now they are approving, they are hailing two other countries that are potentially going to join NATO. What's your take?
Well, NATO should have been disbanded and dissolved in 1990 when the Soviet Union dissolved, and essentially there became no threat to Western society, and instead NATO transformed into this parasitic assault weapon that has terrorized the world. Engaged in color revolutions from Afghanistan to Libya to Iraq and elsewhere. And now we have Ukraine, of course. Before that, there was Bosnia and Herzegovina. So NATO is just a cannibalization monster that is rife with corruption. And it is, employing bureaucratic generals that couldn't get a job if their lives depended on it. So they're really just beta males occupying, a certain degree of employment. But it's tragic because you're witnessing the world lose all of its sanity, especially with Sweden and Finland having the foolishness to trade their neutrality at the behest of the United States pressure, trade their neutrality and safety, and put themselves in a far worse position where now, before they had no animosity or enmity against Russia, And now they potentially risk complete annihilation because Russia is not playing around. It recognizes the NATO threat, and it's responding to that NATO threat. And every nation that tries to intimidate or be part of the aggression against Russia is facing a foe that essentially could annihilate them with superior weaponry and has a moral fortitude greater than all of the European nations combined. Russia is in a very unique position because it has 30 years of betrayal and deceit and lies that have been inflicted against it by the United States, by the United Kingdom, by Germany, by the European Union, by NATO. They've also witnessed the destruction of the Middle East and several of Russia's allies. So I think Russia has recognized that the West and NATO cannot be trusted as an existential threat, and they're making a move to protect their people, their culture, and their homeland.
Scott, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate your time. That was Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer from San Francisco. As the battle for Mariupol in southeast Ukraine is over and the city comes back to life, Johnny Miller reports on the increasing ethnic divide in that country.
Much of Mariupol may lie in ruins, but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods. And humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days, the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed. There are more problems with water, electricity, and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
The population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city and camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything. But there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country and its politics are more independent, and we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, she is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country, talked without a care in the world.
Of course I am happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol, it will now likely be populated predominantly by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, It will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UN Security Council has held a meeting on the worsening global food insecurity. Russia and the United States have blamed each other for the crisis. The U.S. Secretary of State said food supply for millions of people around the world has been literally held hostage by the Russian military. Antony Blinken urged Moscow to stop blocking Ukraine's ports and allow grain exports from the country. Russia's ambassador to the UN said Ukraine itself has blocked the ports for placing mines along the Black Sea coast. Vasily Nebenzia also referred to Western sanctions against Russia and said their consequences are worsening global food insecurity. Ukraine is one of the top wheat-producing countries in the world. Kiev says its exports have fallen sharply since the war began on February the 24th. Iran's ambassador to the UN says unilateral coercive measures violate basic human rights, including the right to food, causing food insecurity. Majid Takhravanchi was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting in New York. He called the measures unlawful and said certain states continue to use them as a weapon to starve the population of the targeted countries. Takhravanchi stressed that food supply must not be disrupted in any way, even during armed conflicts. In this context, he added, UN sanctions should not jeopardize the global food security either. The Iranian envoy said that food insecurity, climate change, and the COVID pandemic have already affected many countries. It said they include Iran, which faces U.S. sanctions as well. The Iranian envoy also spoke about hunger in Syria that suffers from sanctions too. The catastrophic collapse of the former Afghan government and national security forces, as well as the subsequent takeover of the country by the Taliban, were direct consequences of decisions made by U.S. presidents. This is according to an official U.S. agency report. Rahmatullah Bokhban has more from Kabul.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistics support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans, but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
China's president calls for unity among the members of emerging economies known as BRICS to shape global security for all. Xi Jinping urged BRICS countries to enhance political trust and security cooperation to promote peace and development. Xi made the remarks in a virtual meeting of BRICS foreign ministers. Also speaking at the meeting, China's foreign minister said Beijing aims to expand BRICS. China will be hosting the other BRICS members, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, for the 14th summit of the organization in late June. North Korea reports over 260,000 more cases from fever of unidentified origin, pushing the total to over 2 million. The country's official news agency reported two more deaths, bringing the total fatalities to over 60. So far, North Korea has refused to link the fever cases to the COVID-19 pandemic. However, it confirmed last week that at least one of those who died had been diagnosed with the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has slammed officials for not taking practical measures to timely prevent the outbreak of the virus. Kim has also imposed preventive measures, including restrictions on movement and quarantines. Lawmakers in the European Union have called on EU authorities to hold Israel accountable for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The atrocity has just been debated in the European Parliament. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemn the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him. and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the Justice Department has asked the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for transcripts of interviews it is conducting behind closed doors, including some with associates of former President Donald Trump, according to people with knowledge of the situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Glenn Thrush and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Justice Department is set to request transcripts from January 6th committee. In the U.S., the Justice Department has asked the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for transcripts of interviews it is conducting behind closed doors, including some with associates of former President Donald Trump, according to people with knowledge of the situation. The move is further evidence of the wide-ranging nature of the Justice Department's criminal inquiry into the events leading up to the assault on the Capitol and the role played by Donald Trump and his allies as they sought to keep him in office after his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. The House Committee, which has no power to pursue criminal charges, has interviewed more than 1,000 people so far, and the transcripts could be used by the Justice Department as evidence in potential criminal cases, to pursue new leads, or as a baseline for new interviews conducted by federal law enforcement officials. Aides to Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chair of the House Committee, have yet to reach a final agreement with the US Justice Department on what will be turned over, according to a person with knowledge of the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the confidential nature of the investigations. On 20th of April, Kenneth Polite Jr., the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Investigation, and Matthew Graves, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, wrote to Timothy J. Heapy, the lead investigator for the House panel, advising him that some committee interviews may contain information relevant to the criminal investigation that we're conducting. Kenneth Polite and Matthew Graves did not indicate the number of transcripts they were requesting or whether any interviews were of particular interest to them. In their letter, they made a broad request asking that the panel provide to us transcripts of those interviews and of any additional interviews you conduct in the future. A person familiar with the matter said the transcripts were part of a negotiation between the House Committee and the Justice Department, in which the panel was hoping that prosecutors would turn over evidence in exchange for the transcripts. These interviews in the possession of the committee are the property of the committee, said Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland and a member of the House panel. I imagine that the committee will want to see any relevant evidence used with any relevant legal context. Asked about the Justice Department's request after this article was published, Benny Thompson drew a distinction between handing over the committee's materials and allowing certain documents to be reviewed. He suggested that the panel had invested significant time and effort into conducting so many interviews and was reluctant to simply turn them over. We can't give them full access to our product, he told reporters. That would be premature at this point because we haven't completed our own work. A spokesman for the US Justice Department declined to comment. The department's investigation has been operating on a separate track from the committee's work. Generally, investigators working on the two inquiries have not been sharing information with each other, except for, at times, communicating to ensure that a witness is not scheduled to appear before different investigators at the same time, according to a person with knowledge of the inquiries. Thus far, the Justice Department has prosecuted more than 800 people on charges relating to the storming of the Capitol building. But over the past several months, the department has taken steps to widen its focus substantially to look at the planning for the rally on 6th of January that preceded the riot, while also signaling that its investigation would encompass the broader efforts to overturn the election. And in recent weeks, Attorney General Merrick Garland has bolstered the core team tasked with handling the most sensitive and politically combustible elements of the inquiry. Several months ago, the department quietly detailed a veteran federal prosecutor from Maryland, Thomas Windham, to the department's headquarters. Windham is overseeing the politically fraught question of whether a case can be made related to other efforts to overturn the election, aside from the storming of the Capitol building. That task could move the investigation closer to Donald Trump and to his inner circle. A subpoena reviewed by the New York Times indicates that the Justice Department is exploring the actions taken by rally planners. Prosecutors have begun asking for records about people who organized or people who spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the 2020 election, as well as anyone who provided security at those events, and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. They are also seeking information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede or delay the certification of the election, as the subpoena put it. The U.S. Justice Department's request for transcripts underscores how much ground the House Committee has covered and the unusual nature of the situation, where a well-staffed congressional investigation has obtained testimony from key witnesses before a grand jury investigation. The committee has signaled that it is considering making a criminal referral of Donald Trump and some of his associates to the Justice Department, a step that could increase the pressure on Merrick Garland to pursue a case. In a ruling in a civil lawsuit filed by the committee, a federal judge found in March of this year that Donald Trump and John Eastman, a lawyer who has advised him on how to overturn the election, most likely had committed felonies, including obstruction, obstructing the work of Congress, and conspiring to defraud the United States. The House Committee, made up of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans, is led by Benny Thompson and Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, one of only 2 House Republicans to embrace an inquiry scrutinizing the actions of their own party. The panel has about 45 employees, including more than a dozen former federal prosecutors and 2 former U.S. attorneys, and it is spending more than $1.6 million per quarter on its work. The committee has obtained documents and testimony from a wide range of witnesses, including more than a dozen Trump White House officials, rally planners, and some of the rioters themselves. Those witnesses have included White House lawyer, Justice Department officials, security officials, members of the National Guard, staff members close to former Vice President Mike Pence, members of Mr. Trump's personal legal team, Republicans who participated in a scheme to put forward pro-Trump electors from states won by Joe Biden Jr., Donald Trump's own family members, and the leaders of right-wing militia groups. At least 16 Trump allies have signaled they will not fully cooperate with the House Committee. Faced with such resistance, investigators on the panel have taken a page out of organized crime prosecutions and have quietly turned at least 6 lower-level Trump administration staff members into witnesses who have provided information about their boss's activities. Some of those witnesses, including an aide to Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff, have provided critical information. The committee also has tried to obtain testimony from Republican members of Congress, and it has issued subpoenas to 5 lawmakers last week. Those members have denigrated the panel's work, but have declined to say whether they would participate in the interviews, which are scheduled for the end of May. One of the lawmakers, Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, said he received a subpoena on Monday and was currently reviewing it. Merrick Garland and his top aides have been careful about not disclosing their investigative methods, and they have sought to emphasize their impartiality in limited public comments about the investigation. "We investigate conduct and crimes, not people or viewpoints," the Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco said last week during an interview at the University of Chicago. "We follow the evidence," Lisa Monaco said. "It is very evident to do that methodically."
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Saif al-Quds. The 11 days battle during May 2021 between the Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Zionist regime, the fiercest in years, made way for unprecedented developments over the past year. The confrontation of the Al-Quds Palestinians and the people of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to the policy of the occupation and their displacement from their homes constituted a lever for the launch of a Palestinian uprising, which was able to impose itself on everyone's agenda and bring the cause of Al-Quds back to center stage. The most prominent shift in ground events came with the intervention of the resistance in Gaza, which considered the violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and the people of Al-Quds a motive to open fire against the occupation, especially after the people of Al-Quds appealed to their brothers in Gaza. The Battle of Saif al-Quds made way for strategic changes in the Palestinian struggle with the Zionist entity. It brought about a new sense of victory to the Palestinian side and a sense of defeat among the Zionists. The main result of this battle was a change of how Zionists view their own position inside Palestine. The settlers' confidence and trust towards the Israeli army and its deterrent power was dealt a heavy blow, because primarily it could not stop the missiles from the Gaza Strip with their usual airstrikes, while unable to storm Gaza with a ground incursion. Secondly, hundreds of resistance missiles from all parts of Gaza penetrated the Iron Dome. Saif al-Quds reaffirmed the unity of the Palestinian struggle in the face of the occupation in Al-Quds, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the occupied 1948 interior. This founded a practical alternative to the path of reconciliation adopted by the Palestinian Authority, where years had passed without any real breakthrough in that approach. This comprehensive battle was able to establish the Palestinian right in Al-Quds and to refute the occupation's narrative of its right to Judaize Al-Quds and its neighborhoods. Saif al-Quds also allowed the resistance in Gaza to present a professional resistance model and a high ability to confront the Israeli aggression and deal with the plans of the occupation, thus limiting Israel's ability to prolong its aggression against the Palestinians. Saif al-Quds also broke the barriers with the 1948 Palestinians and led to a full-blown uprising, proving beyond any doubt that the occupying state is weaker than what it proclaimed itself to be. Truly, weaker than a spider's web. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. This week, the Palestinian people commemorated the first anniversary of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, known as Saif al-Quds, in which the Palestinian resistance rained thousands of missiles on the occupied Palestinian territories, establishing a new development and resetting the deterrence equation. The Sword of Al-Quds constituted a milestone in the history of the Palestinian conflict with the occupation, as it was a dividing point between the stage of Israeli superiority and the empowerment of the resistance and its blows, which struck the occupied Israeli depths. The battle united the Palestinian people like never before and brought the Palestinian cause back to the fore, after many hypocrites and normalizers with the occupation sought to make it marginal. And some even conspired against it to serve the occupation. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied Al-Quds is Anis Safouri, former Palestinian detainee who spent 12 years in illegal Zionist detention centers and an activist in the Abna al-Balad movement. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Anis. And I know that you are at the moment in the hospital in Al-Quds with our martyr, our hero, Shirin. Shirin Al-Aqli, which was martyred by a sniper in the Israeli occupation army. So that's why you are sitting there in this set right now. We thank you for your effort, for being there. Please do consider yourself as a representative for all of us who are now mourning Shirin and the loss of Shirin. Now, Mr. Anis, Saif al-Quds carried special and exceptional features that distinguished it from other previous confrontations, constituting a defining moment in the entire history of the Palestinian struggle and the developments in the entire region, to be honest with you. What achievements have the Palestinians been able to attain in 2021 or since the 2021 Saif al-Quds confrontations?
The most important achievements of the Palestinian people after Saif al-Quds, or God willing, at the beginning of the liberation, is the unification of the entire Palestinian people under the banner of resistance to the racist Zionist entity. The entity that tried using barbed wire fences and blockades to attempt the conversion of families to separate the Palestinian people from each other and impose a new state in Palestine for its settlers, which it refers to as the Israeli citizens on our land, the land of Palestine. Our Palestinian people truly triumphed because their identity is one, especially that the uprising included all of full historical Palestine. It covered over 27,000 square kilometers, not only in the West Bank, or in Gaza, or in Al-Quds, or Galilee, or the Negev, but all of Palestine was united. This was the most important achievement, because our national identity have existed for thousands of years. And we know that no matter how much the entity tried to isolate us within the occupied territories, we broke that isolation through the sword of Al-Quds. The second important achievement is the emergence of new generations fixated on the resistance approach. These generations have not previously been involved in the uprisings after the Second Intifada in 2005. The battle sword of Al-Quds helped engage this generation in the uprising. They did not take part in Earth Day or the First or Second Intifada. Saif al-Quds allowed us to discover this generation inside 1948 Palestinian territories, which proved that they are not afraid of the Zionists, a generation that is more courageous and not afraid of the racist entity.
Mr. Anis, Saif al-Quds battle still represents the most prominent strategic shifts in the conflict with the occupation so far, as it was able to consolidate the failure of the deterrence policy claimed by the Israeli authorities against the Palestinian natives and push towards more cohesion with the occupation, which was basically evident in the escalation of the individual resistance operations inside the interior occupied Palestinian territories, especially in the first few months of 2022. Were the native Palestinians capable of investing quite well the Saif al-Quds battle in maybe strengthening their steadfastness in the face of the occupation?
A real investment for any Palestinian is defending himself and his identity, and living freely within a free Palestinian state. Real investment is in the struggle, the continuity of the struggle. Saif al-Quds gave us all a motivation that did not exist before. It's truly a battle that strategically shifted the level of deterrence. Certainly, the Israeli entity attempts to show itself in a position of power or victory, miserably failed. The biggest proof of this is the killing and the assassination of journalist Shirin Abu Aqli, who was only doing her job and covering the entity storming into the Jenin refugee camp. As usual, when the entity is not able to confront the Palestinian resistance or resistance in southern Lebanon or any resistance from the rest of the region, it turns to killing children, nurses, and journalists in order to create a state of deterrence. The descent of the Palestinian people to the street and the preparations for a new uprising in Al-Quds during the funerals of the martyrs proved that the Palestinian people have taken the decision to remain free, whatever the price may be. This is the message of our Palestinian people, a practical one from the ground, not just talk.
Mr. Anis, this comprehensive battle in Al-Quds and in Gaza and the West Bank and the interior 1948 occupied territories was able to establish the Palestinian right for Al-Quds and to refute the occupation's narrative of its right to Judaize Al-Quds and its neighborhood, and led to the formation of what we now know as the regional axis of Al-Quds, known as Mihwar Al-Quds, in which all West Asia's axis of resistance is on board. Now, if Zionist Israel maintains its current provocations against the worshippers of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, might we witness an all-out regional war in support of Al-Aqsa, in support of Al-Quds?
It's possible to see a war, but not because of the peoples of our region. The history of the peoples in our region testifies for thousands of years that they love peace. We are a peace-loving people. But the actions of the Zionist entity is what pushes the peoples of the region for fighting with this entity. Al-Quds today is the compass of the free world. Al-Quds is a symbol for the cause of the oppressed people of the world. Al-Quds is a symbol of the state of oppression of the Palestinian people. Of course, I respect the heavenly sanctity of Al-Quds, but I speak at the level of humanity, and especially for the oppressed people, how Al-Quds has national symbolism for them. The Zionist entity is the one who always seeks war in the region. Since the infiltration of the Zionist entity into our region, we have never seen a day of peace, neither here nor in the world. This war is a war imposed on the peoples of our region because of the racist state, which is the occupying entity. Just like the Nazis were eliminated in Europe, just as Daesh was eliminated in our region, we must get rid of Zionism in our region.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Anis Safouri, former Palestinian detainee, who spent 12 years in illegal Zionist detention centers and activists in the Abna al-Balad movement. Thank you very much for being with us, despite the fact that you are visiting our very appreciated martyr, Shireen Abu Aqli, at the hospital. Thank you for giving us the time to be with us and talk to us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the Zionist entity assassinated in cold blood a journalist.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Shireen Abu Aqli was a household name across the Arab world, literally, across the region and beyond. Her calm, commanding presence filled living rooms, courtyards, and camps as viewers turned to the new Al Jazeera Network 24-hour Arabic TV news channel. Joining in 1997, a year after its launch, Shireen made her own history. For a new generation of young Arab women who came of age then and are now a driving force in journalism, she was the first female correspondent they've seen on their television screens. Shireen Abu Aqli was assassinated in cold blood by an Israeli sniper while covering a raid by Israeli occupation forces on Jenin camp in the occupied West Bank. Shireen's martyrdom became a powerful and painful reminder of the huge and growing price paid by journalists covering the continuous Palestinian struggle against the monstrous Zionist occupation. More in this following report.
Veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aqle has been shot and killed by Israeli forces while reporting in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The assassination last Wednesday sparked an outpouring of condolences and condemnation, as well as calls for a thorough investigation to hold the occupation to account. In a statement, Al Jazeera Media Network condemned the blatant murder that violates international laws and norms and called Abu Aqle's death a heinous crime through which it is intended to prevent the media from fulfilling its message. Al Jazeera also held the Israeli government and the occupation forces responsible for the intentional targeting and killing of Abu Aqle. Al Jazeera Network said that the Israeli soldiers targeted its correspondent with a direct shot. It quoted eyewitnesses as saying that a sniper targeted Shirin with a bullet in the face, even though she was wearing a jacket and helmet bearing the logo of the press, and that the Israeli soldiers fired live bullets at the demonstrators and press crews. Journalist Ali Samoudi, who was accompanying Abu Aqle and was shot in the upper back, said, "What happened is that we were on our way to cover the Israeli army operation. Suddenly, they shot at us. They didn't ask us to leave. They didn't tell us to stop. They shot us. A bullet hit me. A second bullet hit Shirin. They killed her in cold blood because they are killers." Ali added in a video recording sitting in a wheelchair at the hospital with bandages on his shoulder. Shirin's body was carried through the streets of Jenin, draped in the Palestinian flag with the press jacket she was wearing. Reporters and photojournalists circled the funeral, this time having to cover the death of one of their own. Shirin was a much-loved reporter and one of the region's most experienced. Her familiar face has always been part of the coverage of major events in the region, and generations of Palestinians have grown up watching her on television as one of the most famous correspondents in covering the continuous Zionist aggression on Palestine. Abu Aqle is considered one of the veteran Arab journalists, and since joining Al Jazeera, she has covered most of the prominent events in the Palestinian territories, and she was one of the most famous war correspondents. After her death, a number of tweeters expressed their grief over her death, and some of them said that they considered her as a member of their families due to her great influence and her long presence on screen. The martyrdom of colleague Shirin Abu Aqle is a crime that has been added to the criminal record of the Zionist entity, and it is imperative for the media and journalist body to unite to denounce it and to make it our duty to amplify the suffering of the Palestinian people so the entire world can hear and see the brutality of the occupation.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us. Now, blue body armor emblazoned with the word press in bold white letters placed on her wooden coffin, on the coffin of our slain martyr journalist, Shirin Abu Aqle. It was a powerful and a painful reminder that journalists are paying a heavy price because of the Israeli continuous brutal aggression against all of Palestinians, but especially against journalists. I don't understand why the world acted surprised when Shirin was assassinated, as if this is something that Israel does for the first time. Why do you think the mainstream media dealt with her assassination the way it did?
Right. As you said, it's far from being the first time. 50 journalists at least have been assassinated just since 2000. And this doesn't include notable cases before that date, such as the 1987 murder of Najih El-Ali. But as we're getting to a point, especially where in this time where the Israel's war crimes are documented out in the open, and this started to proliferate after the introduction of media in Palestine, of Arab media, of Palestinian media, proliferating in the mid to late 1990s, that also accompanied the rise of the internet, it posed like more of a threat for Israel to maintain its pretext of democracy and civilization in the Middle East, and more clearly exposed its the reality of its incessant war crimes. And so the mainstream media basically is in a walking contradiction because it wants to present itself as the authoritative voice on objectivity, but at the same time, it's accountable to capital, it's accountable to empire, and it's accountable to the military-industrial complexes of the United States and Israel, which it maintains a close relationship with their military apparatus and with their intelligence apparatuses, which essentially drive its lines. So this accountability creates this contradiction where there is a denial of the injustices that are happening to Palestinians. At the same time, the world can see its war crimes out in the open, as they have been. So these are also reflected in the editorial guidelines of mainstream media, which deliberately leave no space for the Palestinian narratives, the recognition for Palestinians as the sovereign owners of the land, and of course, as ones that are being ethnically cleansed by the settler colonial occupation.
There's something interesting that happened where Israel cannot lie about it anymore, as you just clearly stated, Julia. But Shireen's colleague and one of the eyewitnesses of her assassination is journalist Ali Samoudi, who was injured himself during that day, said that the occupation deliberately killed Shireen and injured the rest of the crew, even though the place was free of any protesters, demonstrators, or even people throwing stones, for that matter, in the area. Why do you think the occupation assassinated Shireen in specific?
So there is the aspect of Shireen being a prominent journalist, as you said, for all these years, who was a trailblazer in her field, but also an iconic figure that exposed the Zionist war crimes, essentially, in her profession by reporting from on the ground. And being front and center in showing the world what was happening to the Palestinians. So there was her as a figure that was a deliberate target. Second, there's the contextual element of Jenin and of the West Bank facing a renewed and increased siege from the Zionist entity after the resistance forces of, after the Palestinian resistance have consolidated their alliance and are working in unity, particularly after last year's Safe of Jerusalem occupation, successfully and to a level that is a very big threat to the Zionist entity. And the specific site that Shireen was reporting on just last Wednesday when she was martyred was a Zionist attack on the Jenin camp. Mm-hmm. Where there also was a 18 and a 21-year-old murdered, representing also the demographic of young resistance fighters that are posing the biggest threat to the Zionist entity, fighting in armed struggle against the occupation.
Which this brings us to how the Palestinian Authority dealt with it. I mean, I heard and I read for Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtaye, who called for an international investigation involving what he called the United Nations and various parties into also what he called the murder of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aqle. Why is the PA still believing that the so-called international community can bring justice to any Palestinian cause is truly a mystery to me. I mean, entire neighborhoods were wiped out in Gaza last year during the Israeli aggression on Gaza after the resistance tried to help out al-Quds with Saif al-Quds, and not a word came out from this international community. Why should this case be any different?
Right, there's a certain level of hypocrisy that came out of certain officials representing the Palestinian Authority to the UN and to international agencies such as like Riyad Mansour, who were rejecting the possibility of an Israeli probe into attack while at the same time calling for example, the UN or some others were calling for the U.S. to do an investigation. Of course, even if this investigation turns up any modicum of truth more than Israel's potential investigation would, which I don't expect it to really have any different objectives in doing so as allies in maintaining the occupation. But it's just a way for them to kind of maintain their role as the auxiliary representatives of the Palestinian bourgeois class that has basically sold out the sovereignty of Palestinians and of Palestine in exchange for just kind of like some elite control. But also appealing to the international community is increasingly popular in this regard, because the U.S. and the EU can kind of claim to also be impartial in relegating the Palestinian, the issue of the occupation of Palestine and of the injustices that come out of that, as a human rights issue rather than a sovereignty issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely hear that, especially that in the international law, Palestine is occupied, but in their notions and in their understanding, it's not. So we're not going to wait for them to understand it, that it is. I want to thank you very much, Julia Qasim, political writer and commentator from Beirut, joining us to talk about the